Hey there, it's Dane Reinhardt bringing you the President's Perspective, a conversation between current and future leaders of NAHU.
So, this week we're joined by Keith Wallace.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
I guess it's actually morning still there in sunny Seattle, right?
Right. Always sunny in Seattle. It's called liquid sunshine.
Keith is one of those diligent kind of over volunteers, which make us all do a great job. He serves on the membership council as co-chair of Region 8 and also serves this year as the chair of the chapter leadership and development committee. And so you can tell us what else you do, Keith. I know you are part of a Rice Insurance Agency in Seattle, or are you in Seattle, or is it somewhere outside of Seattle? I can never get all that straight.
Bellingham.
Yeah, officially a Bellingham. Seattle. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll give you my 72-floor elevator speech here. When I was a junior in high school, my counselor said, when are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, I was going to play in the NFL. She laughed. She goes, really, what are you going to do? I said, I'll probably be a life insurance agent. And so dreams do come true. Here I am, 30 years in the business, like Dane. I'm a partner here at the firm. We're largely a PNC firm, but we've got a benefits department that I started 20 years ago. So I work in small group, individual, Medicare, and corporate owned life insurance space and individual. So kind of jack of all trades. You know, as far as NAHU goes, you know, I was a member and I got asked to lunch by Sandy Powers Booth, and she asked me to be the legislative chair and coaxed me onto the position with a trip out to DC where I got to meet all the fine people of NAHU. I was sitting in the audience and the light bulb came on. I was with 900 other people that actually do what I do. I felt like I was home. I felt like I was adrift until then. And so NAHU really is, you know, one of the best parts of my day. As you said, I'm a over volunteer. I'm trying to work on having some blank slates in my schedule. So, but currently I'm serving as the CLD national chair. Dane asked me to do that. I said, yes. I'm also serving as the Region 8 co-chair membership, doing that with Jolene Bryant underneath Patrick Burns. And then I am the Washington State membership chair and past president. And then I am the local president for Seattle. So lots of NAHU activity. It's pretty much my second career. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. And I enjoy it.
Good Lord, I wouldn't ask you to be CLD chair if I'd known you were doing all that. I'm glad to have you aboard, but I knew you were doing a lot, but I didn't know it was all that. Good for you.
And even beyond that, Keith was also the recruiter of the year, brought the most new members in last year. So,
well, I made it a goal to win recruiter of the year. I called Michelle Howard, let her know that I was coming and that I was going to do it the right way. I was going to recruit every person that was underneath me. I wasn't going to have anybody stack them. And then Brad Miles out of Region 7 taught me how to be a Triple Crown HUPAC contributor, which is where you give $250 a month and then you give $1,000 at each convention. So it's a pretty simple formula there. So I'm proud to say that that's something that I do and will continue to do. And then if you can see in the background on my video, which you can't, I've joined the Soaring Eagle group as well, where I've got to meet people like Reed Rasmussen, Valerie Kramer, and all sorts of great people. Michael Walker out of Atlanta. So yeah, it's just great. What can I say? I'm a junkie.
I got one of those.
Can I nominate him for Gordon now, David?
Yeah, just go ahead. Yeah, I think you should. I actually got my Soaring Eagle the other day and was kind of intimidated when I pulled it out of the box. The thing looks awesome. So I guess at one level, I think the fundamental thing that we've just done on here is that, you know, we have our NAHU life, we have our life. But I think in your situation, you're at such an interesting point in the experience of our organization because of COVID and also trying to help develop leadership at the chapter level. But I really think it's interesting to kind of hear your perspective about what chapters are doing, can be doing, and what we can do to help them.
Yeah, I appreciate that. One of the committees I'm on is the virtual chapter with David Sherrill. And I think that COVID-19 experience really has changed the NAHU leadership experience as well. You know, I kind of joke that it used to be you just had to show up, put on a set of nice clothes, shake a few hands, and smile. But, you know, the workload definitely has increased in complexity. And, you know, of course, also bringing all the committees together like you've done, David, has created more synergy, which I hate that word synergy. But yeah. And so we're, you know, as far as what chapters are wanting to do, I mean, ultimately, I think that we can make excuses about how COVID is going to affect us, but ultimately, I think that we can use it as an opportunity to bring us close together. And even though people talk about Zoom fatigue, I say BS to that, man. I mean, it's easier to hop on a Zoom meeting than it is to drive across town to attend a 1 hour CE. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting that a lot of, and I mentioned this on a board call recently, that I did a event for Nebraska a couple hours talking about individual coverage HRAs last week, and they had 91 people on this thing. And I don't think they charge anything, but ultimately they had people hungry to be there. And I think, you know, for me, 91 people listening to me for more than 2 hours sounds like a form of punishment. But it was also like the fact that people were interested enough to listen and be a part of it that I think reflects exactly your point. People are hungry to at least have some connection and to get something professionally out of it.
You know, I think along those lines that there's a pent-up demand for the services that we provide. And when people don't see the value proposition of being a member, I think it's really because they're not trying to receive the value. And, you know, you've seen the document that I've created that came when I was driving down the road. I was like, what makes me want to be a member and why? And I started coming up with all the things that we can do. I just think that life in general, you have to actually want to achieve something rather than just have it happen to you. And I think that the NEHU membership is a lot like that. Before you give up your membership, go through a checklist and say, you know, hey, did I read the magazine cover to cover? Did I listen to the podcast? Did I go to a local meeting? Have I joined a board? Did I go to my day on the Hill in both my state and national capitals? Am I sending messages out to my legislators? Am I contributing towards my PAC? Have I recruited somebody to tell them what the value of membership is? And I think that these are the basic constructs of being a member who's active and really getting value. And then I could go into all the certifications. You know, you see all these certifications for professional development that can be had. So I'm just kind of not really into the excuses on why NEHU doesn't meet people's needs and really more into kind of asking them to look at themselves and say, am I doing all I can to achieve the value that I've given at a great, great price of less than $50 a month? Certainly less than what most people spend on Starbucks.
Speaking of Starbucks in Seattle, do you get to Seattle much? Like, tell us about your Seattle interest. David and I did a Labor Day trip couple of years ago, God, it's probably like 4 or 5 years ago, David, where we flew into Portland and then farted around there and then drove up to Seattle and loved Seattle. Like, really, we didn't spend enough time there for our trip before I had to fly out. But do you get down there and like, what's your thing when you get there? And are you a Russell Wilson Seahawks kind of dude?
Yeah, Seattle's a cool town, especially the Seahawks games when they're full of all those people. And so I live 85 miles north. It takes an hour and 15 minutes to get there. Sometimes people treat it like I live in Timbuktu, but it's not that far of a commute. But, you know, I went down there recently for a meeting and not very many people on the streets. You still see some places boarded up. And so certainly the city with all the people that are working from home is not quite the city that it was before. So, but, you know, yeah, we love the Hawks. You know, it's cool that they're 5-0 for the first time. They're letting Russell Wilson throw the ball. Got to like that. But for me, when I go to Seattle, it largely has to do with meeting people related to NEHU. And then I call it a milk run, schedule appointments with people when I'm down that way. I just find that, you know, meeting and talking to people in general is something that really lights me up. I enjoy interacting with other people. But yeah, Seattle, it's an interesting place. It's made up of a whole mix of different people related to their political beliefs. And so, you know, within our own organization, we often have differing opinions on bills that come in and things that are going on. Like, for instance, we've got our public option just being rolled out for 2021.
I was just about to ask you about that, so please.
Yeah, I was just on the Office of Insurance Commissioner Advisory call right before this. And each carrier that is offering a public option also has to offer a standardized plan. The difference between a standardized plan and a public option is the public option is going to be a reference-based model on about 176% of the Medicare reimbursement level for primary care, and I think about 143% for specialists. And it's interesting, it's not set up in every county in the state. And I think that the rural counties are the ones that probably won't have as much public option because the providers in those areas can't afford to take that lower reimbursement rate. But what is an interesting thing about it is that all the public options are paying commissions as if they were the standardized plans. So it's a chassis that looks just like your regular plan, except it's got that reference-based pricing model attached to it, which we anticipate will have smaller networks because doctors may not agree to it. And so it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out, but it's going to actually look like the same plan to people through our state-based exchange.
Is there one network or is there a series of networks?
Series of networks, and we have additional carriers that are coming into the state. And so each carrier will have its own network. And so that's where the challenge exists. And our state-based platform actually has a search for provider option. But of course, you know, you always want to double check that on the carrier website as well, obviously.
So who's actually administering the public option plans? Is it the state technically or what? I mean, how's that actually working?
It is. So our state-based exchange is where all plans must be sold, except for a couple of grandfathered plans. And so when people want to or need to enroll on plans, they have to go through the exchange. I mean, of the first 1 million people that enrolled on our exchange, 800,000 were Medicaid. And even now, we've only got about 170,000 that are on private plans through our exchange. And so really the basis of the Affordable Care Act expansion for us was our expanded Medicaid.
So literally that binds the marketplace, but just that when they buy that public option plan, it's like they're on the Medicaid plan, but providers are getting paid a higher reimbursement rate on those plans.
Yeah, I mean, the Medicaid enrollments are separate than the QHPs. And so the QHPs have a commercial reimbursement rate. And then obviously the public option plans will be somewhere in the middle between Medicaid. One of the best examples I ever heard about the pricing for Medicaid and commercial is if I make pizzas and it costs me $10 to make a pizza, I have to sell it for $8 to Medicare patients. I have to sell it for $5 to Medicaid patients. So I sell it for $20 to my commercial patients. It's a form of cost shifting that occurs. And so, you know, ultimately that's going to occur on pressure towards the other sides of the market when providers getting paid less.
All I got to say is now our podcast is sounding just as legislative oriented as that other one. So, I mean, clearly we're bringing value to the bottom line.
Look at us.
Look at us.
Look at
Well, so hold on. I want to get back to the public option because I was assuming that on the public option, the payer of the financing mechanism was going to be the government, but doesn't sound like that's the case. So there's really nothing public about the risk. It's not government. It's government established with a different reimbursement rate, but it really could be called like a reference-based pricing option, really, right?
It is reference-based pricing mechanism for sure. So in that regard.
So what is public about the public option? I think it seems to be misrepresenting because when I think about public option, I think about it as being an option in lieu of, say, Medicare for All. It's an option that the government's competing with the private sector, but this is the private sector competing with itself with a different platform.
Well, at first, the carriers, the information that I was getting back channeled was that the carriers were not going to participate, but then they came around and now they are. And so you are right. It is a public option on a private chassis. And so, you know, maybe that's a good thing because that keeps us in the game, keeps the carrier in the game. And I think really what's going on is that the government is establishing the pricing.
Oh, that's what it is. So the government's, that's where the government comes in. They're telling the insurers where to try to make pricing work. But they have to be working in collaboration with them. So it's all private market working with the government. So it really is somewhat of a misrepresentation to what we as members might think of a traditional public option being.
Correct.
And if that's what public option looks like, I don't think any of us should be afraid of it.
You know, I agree with you. And I've always liked to look at the glasses half full. Whenever anything comes down, I'm always like, okay, you know, what finally happens versus what we think is going to happen is often very different. And so I think that in business, you have to operate that way as well. I mean, the only constant in life is change. As soon as you think you've got it all figured out, it's going to change on you. And so this is another example of that. And frankly, it's kind of like a Medicare Advantage prescription drug plan. You've got a private carrier offering a government mimicked benefit with control mechanisms on the capitated rate that goes to the private carrier from the government to take on the risk.
So Keith, you and I have something in common where we both started our careers almost identically at the same time. I started literally right out of college. I the first job I got was selling life insurance through the Mass Mutual system to my peers who didn't need life insurance and had no money to buy disability insurance and they had no income to insure. So it was a great way to cut my teeth. And then I stumbled into the group market and found the annuitization of revenue to be incredibly valuable. And here we are today where, you know, all these private equity firms are running around buying agencies for pretty pennies because they've realized what we do is so great on the broker side. in our business. Did you start your career right out of college, or did you do something before you got in?
Yeah, you know, I actually went to college and originally was going to be in like computer programming. And this is before Windows even started. So maybe I missed my mark there. And then my mom is a teacher. So I was going to be a teacher. And then after 4 years of school, I was a playground duty for 2 years. And the grade school kids were starting to show me what it would be like to be a teacher. So yeah, I got through 4 years of school. And then I walked off campus and I went over to meet with a buddy of mine that was selling life insurance for MetLife. Wore a tie, looked good, had a nice car. And I put on my cheap jacket and my tie and I walked in and I said, I want to do what you do. And he said, oh, you're not here to buy a policy. And I kind of should have known right then it's not the easiest thing to do in the world. And like you, I got hired and I had to submit a Project 200, which meant that I had to call 200 of my friends and family. And I went through my whole high school annual. And I remember 1 week I had 15 appointments lined up. And every day I'd come in, I was like, all right, I got 3 appointments today. I'm going to try to help somebody. And nobody showed up.
They all canceled.
So yeah,
no, it's interesting. Of all the life insurance policies I sold in my early 20s to people that were in, you know, sort of my natural list that I also had to create.
Yeah,
every single one of those people that has those policies today is incredibly thankful that they did it. Some were doing $75 a month, and shoot, today they probably have $40,000 or something set aside that they didn't even really think about. And others were more substantial with it, and it became part of their risk portfolio. And what we do and how we help people, whether it's through the Medicare Advantage products, Medicare education, long-term care, the employer marketplace, which you and I know well, and the other things that we do, it's incredibly rewarding when you see families reaping the benefits at the most critical times, whether they've got children that are born prematurely with massive bills that they don't owe, or long-term care families that aren't selling assets to pay for the care. I mean, all these things that certainly in our 20s, it was a little more about the commission, but as we've gotten older, clearly that's not what drives us anymore. What we do is really, truly incredible, and we bring tremendous value.
Well, you know, I delivered $1 million death claim to a widow, and she said everything that they always told us that they would say, which is, now I can pay off my house. Now my kids can go to college. Now my daughter can have a proper wedding. And it's those moments that really help you understand that what we do is so valuable. And the other side of it, though, is that for those who see us from the outside, don't understand the pressure that we have to fulfill these needs for our clients, you know, as a health insurance agent. People call us from the pharmacy. I get a call from the emergency room at 8:30 p.m. wondering about their copay. And it's a pressure that I can't describe, in that if we don't do what we're supposed to do, people's lives are directly affected in a negative way. So I just want to give a shout out to all the insurance professionals who drag themselves out of bed, or maybe jump out of bed like Dane does to do his exercise or ride 112 miles at lunch on his bike. But you know, the work that we do is noble. Yes, we may make a better than average living, but sometimes it doesn't even feel like it's worth it when you're dealing with a situation that just feels so catastrophic for them that maybe you were a part of. So that's just my way of saying, yeah, we do good things for people, but we pay a price emotionally as well. And those of you who are coping and getting up and doing the best job you can, kudos to you and congratulations for being a great professional in somebody else's life.
Keith, it's really been enjoyable to visit with you, and I do admire you and think highly of you. It's been a real pleasure to get to grow an originating friendship with you. And I do appreciate all that you do for the association. And I do look forward to visiting with you again soon. So
thanks
for your time.
I appreciate it. And I hope that you have a great day. And anybody who wants to reach out to me anytime, just give me a call or an email.
So thanks again, Keith, for being with us this week and for giving us a good perspective, a different perspective on public option alone. But I just also have to say, I thank you a lot for your leadership and appreciate you being on. Dane, you want to close us out with your telling people how to get in contact with you?
You can reach me on my mobile phone at 410-746-5281. Please reach out.